1991, New York City. Leonard Lauder stands on the sidewalk. He's on Christopher Street in the lively bohemian neighborhood of Greenwich Village. He's looking across the street, where a crowd is gathered in front of a storefront. Music blasts from large speakers, drawing in curious passersby. It's the grand opening of the first freestanding American store for MAC, an acronym for Makeup Art Cosmetics. The cosmetics brand started in Canada 7 years ago. Lauder joins the crowd. He feels like he's lining up to get into the hottest nightclub. And as a 58-year-old white man, he looks extremely out of place. These customers are young, hip, and diverse. The girl in front of him sports purple hair and a stylish nose ring. Another wears red spandex shorts with high-heeled combat boots. The clientele is just as edgy and fashion-forward as the brightly colored cosmetics sold inside. MAC is not your grandmother's makeup. As Lauder reaches the front of the line, he finds two drag queens greeting customers and passing out coupons. One addresses Lauder, sizing him up. "Welcome to MAC. Check out our special grand opening promotions." Lauder lingers at the entrance.
"Has it been this busy all day?"
"Oh, yeah. Non-stop since the doors opened." Lauder steps into the store. Compared to the beauty brands of his mother's generation, this is like something from another planet. The makeup palettes are bright and flashy, set against sleek black packaging. Neon orange eyeshadow, fuchsia lipstick, bright blue eyeliner. Products like this might come across as tacky, but they're high quality and alluring. Like a set of brilliant paints, they play up the notion of makeup as an art form. As Lauder takes in the scene, he's approached by an impeccably made-up sales associate wearing thick winged eyeliner and lined purple lips.
"Can I help you find anything?"
"You know what? I think I've already found it. Thank you."
By the 1990s, Lauder knows that acquisitions are the next step for Estée Lauder. By purchasing an existing company, you get not only a new customer base, but also fresh creative minds and ideas. But Lauder knows he has to think carefully about which brands to acquire. For his first purchase, he wants something that won't cannibalize his existing brands, Estée Lauder, Clinique, and Prescriptives. And here in Greenwich Village, he's found something completely different. A company that reimagines makeup as a form of radical self-expression. But Estée Lauder isn't the only company looking to expand its portfolio. L'Oreal has similar inklings. But instead of a trendy boutique, their search has led them to the drugstore aisles and a little brand called Maybelline.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. We'll be right back.
In our last episode, both companies persevered through the financial crash of 1987, and L'Oreal relaunched the luxury beauty brand Lancôme to go toe-to-toe with Estée Lauder in the high-end makeup market. But as the market becomes saturated, both L'Oreal and Lauder know they must move quickly to absorb the most promising upstarts, both to keep them from falling into their rivals' hands and to prevent them from becoming serious competitors in their own right. This is Episode 5, Buying Spree. "1993, New York City, Estée Lauder offices. Leonard Lauder sits with marketing executive June Lehman. On the desk between them, a magazine is open to an ad for MAC, a close-up of a woman with winged crimson eyeshadow. Lauder points to it emphatically.
I'm telling you, this company is the next big thing. We need to buy it.
Lehman looks less convinced.
I just don't know. Should we really be focusing our energy on acquisitions? Or our money?
Now you sound like my mother. She's always been against acquisitions. She prefers to keep developing our own brands. But it's hard to find a corner of the market our existing brands don't already account for. Plus, developing our own version of MAC would take years and millions of dollars, and who knows if we'd be able to do it any better.
You have a point there.
When my mother started this company, it was scrappy and small, independent. MAC reminds me of that, and their formulas are good. The products are makeup artist caliber. It's the future, and we don't have anything like it.
But what if we invest more in prescriptives instead? Really see what it's capable of.
You know I love prescriptives, but prescriptives was never really new. It's as if Estée Lauder and Clinique had a baby. MAC is more like a distant black sheep cousin.
So you love that it's exciting and revolutionary, but if you buy this company and it becomes a part of our corporation, it won't be very revolutionary anymore, will it?
Not if we let them continue business as usual. What they're doing is working. Why micromanage them? Look, if we don't buy them, someone else will.
Lehman's still not convinced.
It just seems so outside of our brand.
Exactly. MAC is outside everyone's brand. Young customers love how colorful and playful the products are. And the prices aren't bad either. The customers are diverse. They're all the people we never bothered to advertise to. It's finally a brand for them.
Despite opposition from the board, Lauder goes ahead with the acquisition of MAC. In 1994, Estée Lauder purchases a majority share of MAC, with a plan to purchase the remaining shares within 4 years for an estimated $60 million total. Lauder is true to his word, and MAC co-founders Frank Toskin and Frank Angelo retain creative control of the brand. By the end of 1998, MAC is bringing in nearly $250 million in annual revenue. With one successful acquisition under his belt, Lauder is eager to find more up-and-coming brands to embrace. He decides to look at who is beating Estée Lauder. This way, he can kill two birds with one stone. He figures if you can't beat them, acquire them. And one emerging brand is currently beating Estée Lauder in sales at the New York City high-end department store Bergdorf Goodman. That brand is Bobbi Brown Cosmetics. Just like Toskin and Angelo of MAC, Brown is a professional makeup artist. She got her start in 1991 by launching a simple line of 10 neutral lipsticks. With those classic muted shades, she became an overnight sensation. Young customers who lacked the expertise or confidence to wear bold colors flocked to Brown's minimalist, easy-to-wear products. Aside from the founder's background in professional makeup and an appeal to a young demographic, Bobbi Brown Cosmetics couldn't be more different from MAC. While MAC's known for ostentatious, in-your-face looks that emphasize makeup as an art form, Bobbi Brown products are subtle enough for daily wear. They're meant to accentuate your features, not call attention to the makeup itself. And that approach is exactly what appeals to Leonard Lauder.
"1997.
1995, New York City. Leonard Lauder and Bobby Brown sit on the patio of his stately Upper East Side home, overlooking Central Park. Brown is a brunette in her late 30s with a polished, yet approachable air. The remnants of a meal sit on a table between them. They're relaxed, quietly sipping cappuccinos. Lauder leans in.
You know what I admire about you? You did something different. Everyone else was doing bold looks, red lips, strong contours. You went with subtle. You created a product women wanted that the other companies weren't delivering. And now you're beating us in the stores.
Well, that's just because we're the hot brand right now. You've got the staying power, though. You know, when I launched my first line, I had no idea we'd take off like we did. It was just my husband and me and a drugstore chemist making lipsticks.
Customers know a good thing when they see it. And so does Estee Lauder. Well, I'm sure you know this is coming, but I want to make it official. I want to buy your company.
I'll admit I'm interested. I'm not thrilled with my current business partners. My only concern is creative control. I would still want some autonomy. I don't want to be a cog in the machine.
Oh, you'll be able to keep doing what you love. You understand your customers and your products better than I could ever hope to. But with our support and backing, I think you could expand into the global market. We could make your legacy in this industry so much bigger. Brown smiles.
We'll have to make sure the numbers make sense, but it's a deal.
Lauder beams. Fantastic. I'll have the papers drawn up immediately. You know, there's another reason I fell in love with your company.
Not just because I'm beating you?
No. Because you remind me of my mother when she first started out. With Brown on board, there's one phone call Lauder needs to make first. As a courtesy, he feels compelled to inform the heads of Mac about the decision to acquire Bobby Brown. He's expecting it to be a pro forma chat, but he's dead wrong. Lauder is on the phone with Frank Toskin, and Toskin is laying into him.
You have to be kidding me. Is Mac not enough for you? How can you invite the competition right into the house?
Frank, I promise you, I'd never do anything to hurt Mac. And besides, they're not your competition. Bobby Brown has a totally different customer.
Now we'll be sharing resources with one of the biggest up-and-comers in the industry. I thought you wanted Mac because we're special and different.
You are. And I promise you won't see any decrease in the level of attention or funding you're currently receiving. Toskin is skeptical. But after the first few months of coexisting with Bobby Brown, it becomes clear that Lauder was right. The two brands are so different that they're able to remain on parallel tracks with little interference. Since each brand maintains its independent structure, there is no competition for creative brain power. And Lauder is careful to make sure they each receive the utmost support from Estee Lauder, never pitting the two brands against each other. Now, Lauder has a different big decision to make. Ever since its creation in 1946, Estee Lauder has been a private company, an increasing rarity for a corporation of its age and size. More and more, it seems like it might finally be time to take the company public. But there are a lot of factors to consider. 1995, Lauder sits in his office with Fred Langhammer, his CEO. Langhammer, a 20-year veteran of the company, has a kind, round face and a gentle demeanor. He's an excellent sounding board for complicated issues. Lauder and Langhammer have a strong, comfortable rapport, built from mutual respect and friendship. Lauder leans back in his chair before speaking. I think it's time to revisit the idea of going public.
Langhammer nods. He's not surprised. What's changed?
Nothing, really. I've never been against it. It's just that, well, in the past, it just seemed like an unnecessary complication. But I'm starting to feel like it might be the best thing for my family.
Is something the matter?
No, In fact, that's exactly why I'm considering it. We've survived decades without the business causing any big rift in our family. How many families that are in business together can say that? Next to none. Leonard smiles briefly before leaning closer to Langhammer. Between you and me, my mother is planning to take a step back. Her health hasn't been the same since breaking her hip, and she doesn't want to risk leaving any financial loose ends. From what I've seen in the books, you've done a meticulous job of squaring family debts. That's the thing. I'm tired of being the family banker. As a private company, it's on me to say yes or no when my relatives ask to borrow money from the coffers. And it's a lot of pressure. I know I don't have to explain to you the potential upside of going public. More money, for starters. Leonard bats the idea away with his hand. We don't need any more money. We have plenty of money. Well, then, being able to offer stock options will help us when hiring. It's attractive to top executives in the industry.
That's true. But then again, we have a phenomenal staff. We've never had trouble finding the right people before.
Then why do it? You know the cons. Increased public scrutiny, shareholders keeping you on a tight leash.
True. I doubt we would have survived the launch of Clinique if we had shareholders to answer to. They wouldn't have allowed the risk. But I do like the idea of taking the potential for family drama off the table.
Lauder takes a deep breath before continuing.
There are a couple of things that would be important to me if we move forward. First, I want to price the stock modestly to start. That way our early shareholders get to watch their investment grow.
Let me worry about the math, okay? You worry about the brand.
And I want my family to set aside personal shares to give to our employees as a gift. You know, make them feel included.
I think that's a lovely gesture.
Now, I just have to convince my family.
Lauder gets his family on board. On November 17th, 1995, Estée Lauder goes public at $26 a share. By the end of the first day of trading, it's north of $34, and it keeps trending up from there. Meanwhile, L'Oréal is looking to build on the success of Lancôme. While they've made huge strides in the luxury makeup market, they're now looking to strengthen their foothold in the mass market, particularly in the United States. They've never purchased an American company before, but now they have their eyes on one particular prize. A drugstore brand famous for its mascara in a pink and green tube.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One. At Zoho.one, that's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps, you're licensing peace of mind.
...1996. Lindsay Owen Jones, now chairman and CEO of L'Oreal, sits in his Fifth Avenue office in Manhattan. Across from him is Guy Perelong, CEO of Cosmair, the company's American distributor. Owen Jones, with his dark hair and piercing eyes, is used to being the smartest person in the room. He leans forward.
I think it's time to buy Maybelline.
Perelong is not surprised. They've been having this conversation on and off for years. Maybelline first made waves in the makeup industry when it launched the very first mascara in 1917, and it's been an American drugstore mainstay ever since. Perelong furrows his brow.
Maybelline is struggling. If we buy them now, we'd be taking on $152 million in debt. L'Oreal made $10 billion last year. And we got here by taking risks. I'm not against it. I just think we need to be smart.
Owen Jones slides a folder across the desk to Perelong, who picks it up and opens it, examining a report inside.
Right now, it costs us 46 cents to make a tube of mascara in Europe. Do you know how much it costs Maybelline and their factory in Arkansas?
Perelong scans the report.
20 cents? That's remarkable.
If we acquire the company, we also acquire their factories, their cheaper labor, and their tactics, their ideas. If we apply their production strategy across the board, we can slash our costs. It will make up for their debt before we know it.
This says 93% of Maybelline's business is in the U.S.
And that's exactly what we want. We want to increase our foothold in the American mass market. Their products are already in 100,000 discount and drug stores, Walmart, Walgreens.
But they only made $350 million last year. Compared to the debt, it's not a pretty picture.
I have a plan to turn things around. We do what we did with Lancome. Rebrand. Right now, Maybelline is, frankly, boring. Their customer base is in Middle America. And if you look at their products, you'll see why. Young urban women won't be excited by another pink or red nail polish. We can take it outside the box. Sell yellow and green nail polish. People already love their mascara. We double down on more eye products. We can also expand their profile outside the U.S. I think it's time to pull the trigger.
L'Oreal buys Maybelline for $508 million. And as promised, they reposition the brand to appeal to a younger, trendier demographic, while maintaining the affordable prices. And though Maybelline would never fit the higher-end Estee Lauder profile, the Lauders watch closely as this savvy move increases L'Oreal's profits. Under its new ownership, Maybelline rolls out one new product after another. Wonder Curl Mascara, with a special brush that curls and thickens the eyelashes. Express Finish, a quick drying nail polish perfect for women on the go. Moisture Whip, a moisturizing lipstick. And a new nail polish line called Miami Chill, featuring bright neon colors that up the brand's sex appeal. Within 3 years, Maybelline's sales double. It becomes known as a gateway brand for those new to makeup. Customers flock to purchase its Great Lash Mascara in the signature pink and green tube. And the advertising campaigns featuring model Christy Turlington take off.
Now, it separates, it defines. Lash by Lash. New Lash by Lash Mascara by Maybelline. New Lash by Lash Mascara.
Maybe she's born with it.
And it's not just in the United States where L'Oreal is able to turn things around. 1999, Tokyo, Japan. Owen Jones sits in a hotel bar with Patrick Rabane, the company's head of consumer goods. As they each sip a glass of sake, they ponder what they've just discovered. Owen Jones beams as he sets his cup down.
Can you believe it? Wonder Curl is the number one mascara in Japan. In just 3 months, it has 18% of the market. And customers love how their lashes look curled.
Jones gazes out the window. It's raining.
We should launch a waterproof mascara here next. It would be perfect for the rainy season. But what do we do about Moisture Whip? We figured out the mascara, but lipstick sales are hurting. The formula isn't right. The customers here complain it's too drying. I think we add even more moisture to the formula. A relaunch in the Asian markets. We can call it...
Jones peers at a glass of water on the bar, condensation forming on its edges.
We can call it Watershine. Brilliant. That's the secret, really. We can't just export the same products around the world and expect them to sell just as well everywhere. We have to formulate for different skin types, different climates. Think locally. I think we're going to do big things here.
And they do. In just the first year of doing business in Japan with Maybelline, L'Oreal increases sales from $5 million to $12 million. Maybelline has all of L'Oreal's resources and connections at their disposal, giving them the means to expand the brand's presence in China and Latin America. By the year 2000, L'Oreal is the number one cosmetics brand worldwide. In the United States, Maybelline is the top mass market brand. But years ago, L'Oreal had to contend with the troubling legacy of its founder, Nazi sympathizer Eugen Schuller, and a family scandal dating back to that dark time will once again put the company back into the media spotlight. On our next episode, the L'Oreal founding family goes to court, and both L'Oreal and Estée Lauder continue their race to acquire new brands, now fueled by an unexpected marketing source, beauty vloggers.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is Episode 5 of Estée Lauder vs. L'Oreal for Business Wars. A quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Estée Lauder, we recommend the book The Company I Keep, My Life in Beauty by Leonard Lauder. I'm your host, David Brown. Aaron Conley wrote this story, voice acting by Michelle Phillippe. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Our associate producer is Kate Young, and our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.